This is sort of a rough outline of what I'm going to say, but it's not exactly right, because these slides were made for a philosophical audience. I guess I'm the token philosopher here today. I'll try to serve that role by asking philosophical questions. But I'm going to skip some of the material on these slides, because it's really designed for people who aren't necessarily familiar with some of the mathematics involved, and that's not true here. Normally, we either ignore or kind of background reference frames when we do, for example, just standard undergraduate physics. So, for example, if you were to ask a freshman to answer this question about speeds, most of them would give the first answer, and we wouldn't mark them wrong. But some lazy but close to get the second answer. And you'd sort of be morally obligated to let that one go too. And I'm gonna sort of be the lazy but clever student. Well, maybe not lazy. Keep track of reference frames. The point here, of course, is that the diligent student understands or doesn't understand, but maybe it sort of implicitly understands that there is an implied reference frame by the problem. This student certainly understands that there's an implied reference frame, but ignores that understanding. And that's what I'm doing as well. And I think it's important to do, because although in the end, in quantum theory, when we're doing at least at the same level of introductory quantum theory, and even when we're doing something more than introductory quantum theory, we often don't worry explicitly about the reference frames at all. We just grant ourselves things like R3, which in a Schrodinger representation become positions. We don't ask too many difficult questions about what exactly that means. But if pressed, we better be able to answer the question, what exactly does that mean, if you want to make contact with actual experiments. And so I'm gonna try to do that a little bit today. I'm going to do it in part from a kind of historical perspective, at least starting off, and then move into a somewhat more mathematical discussion of the relationship that I think there might be between careful keeping track of reference frames in quantum theory and circuit principle. Is my voice loud enough? I know I'm not speaking into the microphone, because I don't want to stand like this.
But you can move the microphone around.
Okay. Can you hear me okay? Anyway? Okay, I'll take that as a yes. Historically, what is there to say? Well, there's lots to say, and I'll just hit some highlights. Newton, of course, was aware of what later came to be called the observational equivalence of inertial frames. He didn't have that terminology. The observational equivalence of them under Newtonian laws. Of course, instantaneously, it's trivial that any frame you pick to describe your system is as good as any other, but the point, of course, is that even over time, one inertial frame is as good as any other. So dynamically, they're all the same. But the issues that are really, I think, underlying the concerns one might have in quantum theory don't get going until the 19th century, when the unobservability of absolute space began to raise two important issues or problems rather explicitly. The first of these is simply how to make empirical sense of the law of inertia. What does it mean empirically as stated? So how did Newton state the law of inertia, which is the way in general would have been stated in the 19th century, or at least equivalent. Newton says every body continues in its state of rest, or of uniform motion in a right line, unless it's compelled to change that state by forces pressed on it. So that's a quotation from Newton. And the obvious question is, well, what do you mean by rest or uniform motion? Or another way of putting it is, relative to what is the body at rest? Now, Newton might have been inclined to say absolute space. And that's a good enough answer if you want to make the law of inertia well defined, as long as you believe that there's such a thing as absolute space, which of course he did. But that doesn't make it empirically meaningful, because as Newton himself was well aware, we didn't have empirical access to this canvas of space. Well, by the 19th century, various people, I'll just mention Neumann and Lange, began to worry explicitly about this question, what could this law of inertia actually mean empirically? So Neumann, for example, not really yet solving the problem, but what he realized is that you can define a measure of time by considering two bodies that are free and moving in distinct straight lines. And in the context of Newtonian mechanics, if you've got two bodies like that, then you can just mark off the times at which they move proportional distances, and those will be equal measures of time up to scale. And Lange then, using sort of the germ of that idea, defined the notion for the very first time. This is in 1885. Defined for the first time the notion of an inertial system. And he defined it as follows. He said it's a system of coordinates in which each of three force-free bodies moving away from a common point, moving in straight lines away from a common point in non-coplanar directions, so they can't be moving in the same plane, travel mutually proportional distances in the same times. So if you think about that for a minute, you'll realize, in fact, you can define an inertial frame. That is to say, a coordinate system that's inertial using three such bodies. The law of inertia, then, is just the plane that any other force-free body will also move proportional distances and proportional times relative to that, relative to the coordinate system that you define with your three free bodies. So the law of inertia is now empirical. That is to say, find me three bodies that do that, and then go find another one that you claim to be force-free, and we'll check to see whether the law of inertia is true by seeing whether it, in fact, moves in proportional distances in the same amount of time. But, of course, it raises another question, which is, well, how do I find an inertial frame in the first place? And, in fact, it even raises the question whether there is such a thing. It certainly isn't the case that any old three bodies are going to work. There's a related issue, which is always going to be an issue in this discussion, which is how do I determine whether a body is force-free? But the real question is, how can I find an inertial frame in the first place? Or how can I even show that there is one? And in the end, that question, I'm summarizing this issue very quickly, there's a lot more to say, which I won't, but in the end, that question kind of put the roadblock on that particular approach. And so there was another approach in the late 1880s by Thompson and Moorhead, in which they simply stipulated that an inertial frame is one in which Newton's laws are satisfied. That is to say, the second, third laws are satisfied. So the first law, the law of inertia, actually just becomes an existence claim. There is a frame in which the second and third laws are satisfied. Again, that makes it empirical. Right? You've got empirical work to do now. Go out and find such a frame. And you either find one or you don't. Now, from this point of view, the task of finding such a frame is absolutely crucial, if you're a Newtonian. Why is it absolutely crucial? Well, apart from the fact that the first law claims that there is such a frame, and therefore finding one amounts to checking the first law under this understanding, it's also the case that Newton's second and third laws are true in and only in an inertial frame. And that fact, when you look at Newton's theory from that point of view, then it becomes absolutely crucial to find such a frame, because otherwise, what are you doing applying the laws? If you're not applying them in a frame in which they're actually true, then you're misusing the theory. Okay, so how do we go out and find these inertial frames? Well, until 1718, you could have just pointed at the fixed stars and said there's one. But Halley in 1718 realized that the fixed stars were calculated, the fixed stars were not in fact inertial. He did that by comparing contemporary observations with Ptolemaic observations of the fixed stars and realized that they were moving relative to each other, so they weren't fixed. So how do you do it? Well, there is actually an international, I don't know what to call it, association. Some of you may know what the right terminology is. Anyway, it's called the International Earth Reference and Rotation Service. And it grew up for a very practical reason, which was to determine the motion of the axis of rotation of the Earth, which is a very important thing to know if you want to navigate. And it does funny things once you start making finer and finer measurements of this. If you want to do things like get your satellite over just the right part of Australia, right, then you've got to know exactly how that axis of rotation is moving. So that's why they're still around. And one of the things they do is try to find the very best, this is all classical, by the way, there's no general relativity involved here. They try to find the very best reference frame they can. And as far as I understand it, my knowledge is about 2 years old, so this may have changed my job. As far as I understand it, the state of the art is a reference frame determined by some 212, 219 radio sources that are some very far distance away. And this thing is referred to as International Celestial Reference Frame. And it's sort of a standard that everyone agrees to use as reference frame. More importantly, it's the most accurate one anyone knows about. That is to say, it's the one in which Newton's laws are, as far as you can tell, completely satisfied. That is to say, up to the level of accuracy of measurement, which is something like 10 to the minus 5 radians of the location of the radio sources. Now, that's not pretty accurate, but I guess it's worth pointing out that these things are super far away, and they're probably pretty heavy, and so 10 to the minus 5 radians actually could be masking a huge amount of movement that you can see. Nonetheless, it's the best we've got. Okay, so there's a little bit of history. The question I want to ask now is a question that that Niels Bohr asked quite some time ago, and that is, can there be a reference frame in quantum theory? And the issue that Bohr noticed is the following. I'll come back to this about the ice era later, but it's just background for the moment. The issue that Bohr is worried about, I'm sure you're familiar with it, is the following. A reference frame, supposedly, is something that defines simultaneously position and momentum. And if you're going to have an actual body that's serving that purpose, or a system of bodies such as the ICRF, or the center of mass of the hydrogen, or whatever, if you're going to have a body that's actually serving that purpose, that is to say, relative to which you're willing to define precise positions and momentum simultaneously, well, then quantum theory is going to tell you you've got a problem. You can't find such a body. So the story goes. And so that's the issue. Bohr's response, which is one with which I have a certain amount of sympathy, but I also have a reservation I'll mention in a minute, but Bohr's response is, look, what you have to do is just stipulate that such and such serves that purpose. Now, it's not a once and for all stipulation. You can always step back and talk about that thing, whatever it may be, quantum mechanically. But in any given measurement situation, you just have to say, this thing is a reference body, it determines my reference frame. And in the context of that measurement, I don't ask questions about it. Right? I just stipulate that it can serve that purpose. Now, I have a certain amount of sympathy for Bohr's response to this problem, but it does mask an important distinction, one that's been floating around today already, and that is the distinction between inertial and reference frames. We can choose our reference frames as we wish. I can tell you the location of this piece of paper relative to anything I care to mention. That thing could be moving, it could be doing anything you like. And in fact, we do this all the time in physics, right? For convenience, we might solve a problem in rotating coordinates or whatever. Yeah, okay, it introduces Coriolis forces. So what? We can still do the calculations. So the point is, for the purpose of telling you where something is, or what its momentum is, or what its spin is in some given direction, or whatever, I can choose anything as a reference body and define a reference frame with respect to that. An inertial frame, of course, is a very different sort of thing. It has to have special properties. And more importantly, if you think now about the observations we made a minute ago, from the point of view that says the law of inertia is an existence claim, and an inertial frame just is, something which the second and third laws are true, from that point of view, if I want to use a reference frame, and I want to use it not just at an instant, which at an instant anything's true, if I want to use it over time, as I want to write down some dynamics in the coordinates given by the reference frame. In that case, even though I can, if I like, use anything I like as a reference frame, could be rotating, could be doing whatever crazy things you want, I have to at least know how to do it in principle in an inertial frame. Right? That's how I know, for example, when I use rotating coordinates to introduce fictitious forces. I know to do that because I know that in an inertial frame, that I'd have to compensate for the rotation of the coordinate system by introducing those forces. This was all worked out in the 18th century, actually, although they didn't really have the concept of an inertial frame yet. But that's when this was worked out for the first time. It's all obvious to us now, but I think it's worth mentioning. It's worth mentioning, really, to emphasize the point that when I choose something to be a reference frame, at the very least, what I have to know is how that thing is related to some inertial frame. Because it's the inertial frame where I know how to write down the dynamics in principle, because that's the frame in which the dynamical laws are actually true. And I can translate those laws, if I like, into some other, whatever reference frame I care to name. But I have to at least know how to relate my description back to the inertial one. That's the claim. Okay. Let's look at an example very quickly. And that is the hydrogen atom. And it's already been discussed, if you all are familiar with it anyway, so I'm not going to discuss the details. I'll just flash this in front of you for a moment. Right, so there's a very familiar story, and that we've all done this in our audit, first year quantum mechanics, how to solve hydrogen by performing separation variables, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The point that I want to make about it, and that was really just to jog the memory, is the following. It's not normally written down this way, although you can find it written down this way, for example, in Schiff's book. Is what you really ought to do, so I claim, in principle, even though this isn't in general what we do, normally we just start off working in the relational coordinates, but what you really ought to do is write down Schrödinger equation for a two-particle system containing, obviously in this case, electron and proton, and then, as Schiff shows us how to do in the book, this is how he actually does it, perform whatever changes of variables, et cetera, you want. So in this case, what we do is we re-coordinatize to relational and center of mass coordinates. It's still working, though, in this two-particle system. And then you do the usual thing, change to spherical coordinates, et cetera. But the point here at the bottom is that you're now working in relational coordinates. What you can do, of course, is throw away the center of mass stuff. Just what you're really interested in is the relational coordinates at the end. And it's actually an important observation. I mean, this is related to stuff Rod was saying. This is kind of what Rod was saying for dummies, I guess. There we go. It's important because, I mean, think about what would happen if you translate the whole thing back into these absolute coordinates that I started with. So do the whole deal, right? Start off in your absolute coordinates if you like. Switch to relational coordinates, throw away center of mass, switch to spherical coordinates, anything you like. The usual things you do when you solve the hydrogen. What happens when you want to switch back to the absolute coordinates? The first thing you have to do is put back the center of mass here. And then perform the appropriate transformation, which I didn't do. But if you just look at these relationships between the coordinates of the here and usual solution, the hydrogen atom, and what we have to report as we started with. What becomes clear is that the rate, the wave function for the compound system is entangled. It's an entangled state involving both proton and the electron. This is not surprising. I mean, it's because what you had anyway was something that was a relational fact about the hydrogen atom in the first place. If you had the relational coordinates and the center of mass coordinates, you just threw away the center of mass coordinates. So what's important to notice here is that when we were working in these, what's important to notice is that if you don't keep in mind the fact that you're really working, what you really have here is a two-particle system, you might be inclined, I've certainly seen students do this, you might be inclined to think that the thing you normally write down at the end of working out the hydrogen is just a description of the electron, right, which clearly is not. Right? It's a description of the entire system. Okay. All right, that's all background material. And I think I'll stop there except to make a few other observations about the hydrogen atom. And the first I've already said, and that is to get a relational description of the hydrogen atom, what we did was we threw away some coordinates, namely the center of mass coordinates. So the coordinates, the center of mass coordinates in the end are not part of a mutual description of the hydrogen atom. They're in fact definitive of it. What do I mean by definitive of it? I mean, they tell you how to relate the description you have to the actual physical world. They're, in some sense, providing you the reference frame for the rest of the description. Because your relational coordinates are, of course, coordinates that are relational to what is going on. It's important, though, and this is relating now to the point I was making earlier, it's important that we can't just do this in any old way. Suppose, for example, that the center of mass doesn't move freely. Then the usual steps that you take to solve the hydrogen atom are not valid. If the center of mass doesn't move freely, you can't throw them away in the way that you normally do when you solve the hydrogen atom. The point, in other words, is that the center of mass, you have to know ahead of time that the center, or assume, that the center of mass is itself defines an inertial frame. It's only because the center of mass coordinates define an inertial frame that the rest of the procedure works in the first place, in the usual solution of the hydrogen atom. I'm not saying you can't do it if they don't move inertially. I'm saying you can't do it in the usual way of just throwing them away and assuming the Schrodinger equation applies to the relational coordinates. It doesn't necessarily apply to them if the frame defined by the center of mass is not inertial. Finally, relating to the point that I made on behalf of Bohr, assuming that what I said about Bohr was plain thought, it's always dodgy business to assume, that notice that what we assumed about the center of mass coordinates is that they move freely in which coordinates? In those absolute coordinates I started off with, the x, y, z for the proton and electron. Another way of saying that is, we assume that the Schrodinger equation was valid in those coordinates. And we simply assume that we have no reason to think that, a priori. Okay. Okay. So all that is sort of background information to get the juices flowing, I guess. Let's now think about what one does in classical mechanics. Everything I just said is true with making the appropriate changes. In classical physics, it's just as much as quantum. Nothing I said so far is inherently quantum mechanical, except for the remark about the entanglement of the state of the solutions of the hydrogen. Why is it that in classical physics you can just not really worry about this problem? Well, the reason you cannot really worry about the problem is, as long as the frame that you're actually, the body, I should say, that you're actually using to define a reference frame, as long as that thing is good enough, as long as it's close enough to inertial, you can show, in two seconds, it's absolutely true. You can show that whatever calculations you make, whatever application of the laws of motion you make in that nearly inertial frame is very close to whatever calculations you would make if you were handed an absolutely inertial frame. This is a trivial, not even 2 miles, maybe 1 mile calculation. And so what you have to know in quantum mechanics is the same thing, right? Because we're not handed absolutely inertial frame. Right? That was part of the point of the discussion of this ICRF. Right? We don't know that that thing's absolutely inertial. What we know is we can't make a measurement to show that it isn't or is. So no one hands us an absolutely inertial frame. What we're handed is the best thing we can do. And what we have to show ourselves is, given the best we can do, is that good enough? Are the laws, you know, as if we just assume that Schrodinger's equation applies in that almost inertial frame or possibly almost inertial frame, is that going to be very close to, or as close as we need to, applying Schrodinger's equation in some absolutely inertial frame? The answer in classical physics is trivially yes. The answer in quantum physics is also kind of trivially yes. And that's what I want to talk about for the rest of the time today. I say kind of trivially yes because, on one hand, the answer is yes. I mean, the calculations you make in a nearly inertial frame are provably very close to the calculations you make in an exactly inertial frame. That is to say, one in which Newton's laws are as a part of, sorry, Schrodinger's equation is absolutely valid. On the other hand, what you have to, the process you have to go through to convince yourself of that raises other questions, particular questions about uncertainty. And that doesn't happen in classical physics. In classical physics, when you do the one-line proof, nothing interesting falls out except the fact that it was okay all along for you to be applying Newton's laws, you know, relative to some nearly inertial frame, nearly enough for your purposes. Okay. I want to switch gears now for a minute and get a little bit more mathematical. I'll say something about what actually motivated me in the first place to start thinking about this stuff. So this is the big picture, and then I'll speak a little bit more mathematically rigorously. So what got me started thinking about reference frames and all this business is really thinking about permittivity. Coming to believe on those grounds, for reasons that I'll outline in a minute on this slide, that there must be some sort of connection between a constellation of different things, including the notion of a reference frame, the Galilean group, and the uncertainty principle, on the basis of very well-known theorems, at least well-known probably to most of you. So here's the big picture. As you all know, observables can be defined in terms of their transformational properties, and I'll say more about that rigorously in a moment. And then such an observable, one that has certain transformation properties with respect to some group of interest, in my case, really just for simplicity, I'm just going to talk about the Galilean group the whole time, in fact, just part of the Galilean group the whole time. And so if you have an observable that has the right transformation properties with respect to the Galilean group, namely that it's covariant in a way I'll define in a minute, then it forms part of a so-called system of permittivity. And then you've got a whole, really, not just one permittivity theorem, but a whole host of theorems that do a variety of things for you, one of which is allow you to derive certain kind of uncertainty relations, more precisely, Weyl relations. Well, the point here, and the connection with the notion of reference frames, is that the transformations that you use to define observables are also implicitly, they also help you define the notion of a reference frame. Or another way of putting it, if I didn't think about this next half of the sentence, another way of putting it is simply this, that when I go to check classically, let's start off with classically, so when I go to check classically that my almost inertial frame is good enough, right? What I really do conceptually is I apply certain transformations from that frame to an absolutely inertial frame and see whether my answers don't change much under those transformations. Well, I have to do the same thing in this case, right? Quantum mechanics, I do conceptually exactly the same thing. I make a transformation from my almost inertial frame to an absolutely inertial frame. And I make sure that that transformation doesn't mess up my answer too much, doesn't mess up my calculations too much. Well, I figure out what those transformations are by, in fact, looking at exactly the same transformations that, for example, the five inline variables are, and that I use to define systems of informativity. Okay, and as I say here, then, to my mind, at least, the above observations, I'll say the piece of those observations are in a minute, suggest, although admittedly only suggest, the connection between the notion of the reference frame and the uncertainty relations. Okay, so let's look at a few details. You've all seen this before, so I'm really just going to put it up here for the purpose of notation, because it can focus. Oh, there we go. Okay. Right, so you all know the stuff on the bottom, but just to establish notation for the agents of complex separate global space, elevators and found operator line. S is a locally compact topological space, intuitively it's a set of possible values of an observable that I'm going to define in a moment. And B of S is the sigma algebra L set of S. And then we can define in the usual way, I won't read through this, a positive operator value measure that has to obey certain properties. It's a measure from B of S to the bounded operators, and it's a spectral measure under the usual condition. Okay. This is also familiar to you, so I'm just going to put it up to establish notation again. I'll put it at the bottom. So currently G is going to be some local compact topological group. I'm doing this all pretty abstractly, but really for my purposes, it's Galilean group, almost always. In fact, in this talk, unless I have more time than I think, it will always be the Galilean group. Alpha is just some action of G on S, where S is this intuitive set of possible values of some observable yet to be defined. This is just a shorthand that says there. And then U of G is some continuous interior useful projection representation. Although I'm going to very quickly just assume that the representation is just one modification of that. Okay, so here's what we mean by invariance and covariance. E, which remember is just a map from delta elements of the rel subsets of S to positive operators. And we just say that the POD measure is invariance under the group in case the obvious thing holds, namely taking delta map to its corresponding positive operator, plus the representation of G act on it, and you get the same thing back again. And covariance, just in case, again, the obvious thing. Okay. E act on the translation, if I can use that term, of delta is the translation of E act on delta. I'm just using translation as a generic term for the group act. Okay. Again, really just to establish notation. So now I'm going to let G be the Galilean group, and that can see it. So, and that's just consistent time translation, spatial translation, groups, and rotations, although I'm really going to just talk here about translations and rotations. And I assume you all know the action of G on R4 is. I can go with that. Okay, so now, how do you define things like position and momentum? Again, I assume you're familiar with this. We can define position by letting the space S just be R3. Although, in a little while, I'm going to switch gears and select this something fancy with R3, but R3 is good enough for now. And so these things, so the Borel sets then just represent propositions like the particle is located at some point whose coordinates are in delta. That's at least the first go at some interpretation of what these things mean. People can and certainly do dispute what the proper interpretation of these things is. Let's just leave it at that, not use interpretation for now. And then you can define a position operator by letting Px be the POD measure of the position and then define this integral in the usual way. Everything works the same way for momentum. Here's the crucial point. We're going to require, in this whole discussion, position the invariant under boosts and covariance under translations. Remember, these are instantaneous boosts and translations. These aren't obviously position is covariant if you do a translation, let that happen. Invariant under boosts, if you do a boost and let some time pass. This is an instantaneous boost. And momentum, of course, is just conversely invariant under translations and covariant under boosts. Those points will become very important in a minute. My discussion is going to focus on producing momentum, but we can do this for other observables. In fact, one very interesting case is the case of angle, which you can do in a variety of ways. And I'm not going to go through the details here. I probably don't even have time to. I'll just give you a kind of impressionistic view of how one can do angle. So one approach to angle is simply to piggyback on position. And there you're going to do what I take is probably the obvious thing, and just use basically the Pythagorean theorem to define what you mean by angles. And that's one approach. And what's interesting is that the angle operator that you get when you do the obvious thing that's written down there here is conjugate to angular momentum in the z direction, where z is arbitrarily chosen, in the sense of the vowel relations. Another way of saying that is just that direction in space and angles away from that direction are complementary. Another way of doing angles with spin, that's somewhat more complicated. I think I don't have time to do that, sorry. Okay. So now, to give you a Hilbert space, a set of values of observable, a group, action of the group, a representation of the group, and a POV measure that's covariant under the group, then, if E is an actual PD measure, not just a POV measure, then what you have is a so-called system of imprimitivity. It's a POV measure. You can usually dial it into a system of imprimitivity anyway. We'll just talk about PD measures for now. It's fine. And then you can apply the imprimitivity theorem, which, if you've never seen it before, my reading it to you isn't going to help, so I'm not going to read it. But if you have seen it before, it may jog your memory to read it again. But the crucial point's in the bottom, and that is that induced representations are essentially unique. So let me say a little bit more carefully what that means. And let's do it in a slightly more concrete setting, where we're going to talk about position at the start, and the Galilean group. So let's let S, elements of S, that's the set of possible values, we're going to let those things, let me do it more generally than that, without such notation. Consider the Galilean group with just translations and rotations. And suppose you've got a representation of the rotations. And you build a bigger Hilbert space in a way that if you want me to describe during questions, I'll be happy to do. If you build a bigger Hilbert space, you've got a representation of the rotations on some Hilbert space. If you're going to build a bigger Hilbert space, it's something cross the Hilbert space you've got the representation on. And what that something is, I don't want to say because it'll take you too much time. And you want to find an induced representation then of this piece of the Galilean group, namely rotations and translations, on that bigger Hilbert space, then what the imprimitivity theorem tells you is that induced representation is essentially unique. The one you get by starting with the representation of the rotations on the smaller Hilbert space. So for example, in the case I'm talking about, if you start off with trivial excitation with the rotations on one-dimensional Hilbert space, right? So that just maps everything to be identical on that one-dimensional space. Which, granted, it's not a very interesting representation, but if you start with that, then what you get on the bigger space is just the Schrodinger representation of the position of the single particle. In fact, Matthew shows us that if you let the dimension of the space on which you're representing rotations get bigger and bigger, right, so let it go to 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., then what you get is representations of spin 1 half, etc., etc. The representations of particles are going to get higher and higher spin. Okay, so what lessons do we learn from this physics about permittivity? Well, first lesson we learn is that all representations of position, this is all non-relativistic, right? All representations of position are unitarily equivalent to the Schrodinger representation, under the assumption that position is covariant with respect to. Okay, fine. Under the assumption that position has the right variance and covariance relation with respect to Galilean. Okay. You also learn that the roles that P and Q play, position and momentum play in the representation of the Galilean group, is fixed. Once they're presumed again to obey the correct symmetry, what I call the correct symmetries in this context. For example, we didn't assume this in this way that momentum generates translations in the position. That's just a result of the analysis. We're also a very short step away from the uncertainty relations. In fact, I don't have time to show you, but just a very quick application of Stone's theorem, plus a little few, some people think major, some people think minor assumptions, and you can get the viable relations for position momentum right away. Okay, so in the last 5 minutes, now how does this all relate to reference? So that's a discussion on permittivity, and the point you should take away from that is just this. If you define position momentum as those observables that have, let's say, the correct covariance and invariance relationship with the Galilean group, then you get viable relations to position momentum, which means, in essence, not causing the quibble about technicality, in essence, you get the uncertainty relation between position and momentum. So all of that, to my mind, suggests some possibly interesting connections between the notion of a reference frame, which can be defined in terms of invariances, and the notion of an uncertainty principle. So here's further suggestiveness. So kind of exploring the possibility of such a connection then, let's quickly consider the situation that I said we ought to consider at the outset, namely convincing ourselves that in quantum mechanics, when we assume that Schrodinger's equation holds in some frame that we know doesn't really hold, but it's close enough for our purposes, that it's legitimate to use that frame as a reference frame. And earth performing. So the situation we're supposed to envisage here is we have an internal observer sitting in a lab making measurements of some particle, sigma 1, relative to some lab, sigma 0. And we have some external observer out here standing in some absolute inertial frame. Of course, we don't really know where that frame is, but we imagine there's such a person out there observing what's going on inside this lab. And so the external observer's task is to describe in his own language what the internal observer is really doing. The internal observer has no knowledge of what's going on in the outside world. Right? She's in a box. Well, what we have to do, and this is something that Aharonov and Kofersch long ago showed how to do, is make transformations between what's going on inside the box and what's going on as described by the guy outside the box. And what they didn't point out is that this transformation that I wrote down as UAK, this unitary transformation, that thing just follows from the considerations of permittivity that I mentioned earlier. I mean, if you read their paper, which is actually extraordinarily confusing, at least to me it is, but if you read the paper, it looks like they just said, well, let's try this. And maybe that's what they were doing, I don't know. But there's no, well, let's try this. That has to be the answer. And you can sort, I mean, you can derive it as an answer. You can also sort of check that it's the answer by checking sort of easy cases like this one. Let's do a transformation. We're transforming from interior observer's coordinates, right? That's to say the coordinates the interior observer will apply to the measured system when measuring it, taking the lab to define the absolute frame. And we're translating them to what the exterior observer says, well, here's what's actually going on. And of course, that's exactly what you'd expect, where zero is the number of the system, is the lab. So system zero is the lab. System n is some particle inside the lab captured by the interior observer. Slightly more complicated, but still pretty obvious. If you take interior's free Hamiltonian, you get something that looks right, so it has a kind of drift term for the lab. So the exterior observer can say, yeah, that's right, except that whole lab is moving. And that's something, of course, the interior observer doesn't know about. Okay, here's the punchline. Well, it's not really a punchline, it's more like an instigation to further thinking about it. So here's the end of the talk. Suppose you're going to make a measurement of position. And suppose we're going to take, in the spirit of Aronoff, I guess, a very simple model of a position measurement, in which you just have a free part of the Hamiltonian, which I didn't. No, this would be an equal sign, that's the problem. Okay, so this is the internal observer Hamiltonian. It's the thing that you and I write down when we think we're making a position measurement. And it's just a free part plus an interaction part plus obviously a very oversimplified way of that. And you know, maybe a simplified model, but it generates the right answer. It generates a correlation between a measured observable, which is the position of, let's say, system one, which is the same measure for system two of the apparatus, and some pointer observable, which we'll call Q2 in the interior coordinates. So it may be oversimplified, but at least it does the right thing. And from the absolute point of view, just using the transformations I have in the earlier slide, it's all very trivial mathematically. From the absolute point of view, here are some observations. So the interior guy just does the measurements using that Hamiltonian, which, you know, we might, if we were lazy, write down as the Hamiltonian describing the measurement. And the exterior person will say, okay, now what's really going on? Well, what's really going on is, well, first of all, we have two sanity checks, right? First of all, according to the exterior observer, the total momentum of the lab and everything in it doesn't change. If it did, then we'd know something really weird is going on. Because all the interactions happen inside the lab. But according to the exterior observer, the momentum of the measured particle, momentum of the measured particle changes. Well, that's not too surprising because you interact with it inside the system, inside the lab. But here's the weird one. Right. Remember that the interaction Hamiltonian, which you can still see at the top there, doesn't involve the lab, which is system zero. Nonetheless, from the exterior point of view, the momentum of the lab is disturbed. What's the lesson? Well, the lesson, I think, is that the interior guy is going to say to him or herself, okay, I'm now making a position measurement. Does it make sense for me to use this lab to define simultaneously momentum while I'm making a position measurement? Well, unfortunately, the interior observer doesn't have any way to step out as an interior observer, any way to step out of the lab and check to see what happens to the lab. But what the interior observer can do is imagine that there's an exterior observer sitting in the absolute frame of reference who is able to do exactly that, right? Who is able to do this. And what that interior observer will, not even having to know anything about where this absolute frame is or how to locate it or anything like that, what that interior observer can know is that according to that imagined exterior observer, my lab is not appropriate for defining momentum. Why? Because its momentum is not conserved during this interaction. And so my view is that should be a hint to us that doing things like taking care to ask what would be true in the absolute frame and so on and so forth is somehow connected in ways that I don't pretend to have made clear with the uncertainty relations. Thanks. Questions?
summer? What else would? So how does, so does it play on the masks, the masks, how can it move into some RFP?
Oh, good, yeah. Well, the answer is, I mean, you can go to a large, you can ask, and board districts itself, board is constantly emphasizing as well that the ladder is very big. And there's a certain sense in which that does mask, I mean, in a very familiar way, that does mask it. So, on the other hand, it doesn't change, like, the amount of disturbance of momentum and stuff, but it changes the amount of disturbance of its velocity. I mean, in a kind of naive sense. But as far as I understand it, the only way we have is measuring velocity by measuring momentum and divided by mass. So it's not gonna eliminate the uncertainty. All it will do is make the lab not feel like something.
Can I just have a sort of prescription for things?
Well, what I should, okay, let me say something else about that. Everything I wrote down there is purely qualitative. Right? I mean, I haven't calculated, I guess, from the difficult to do sort of how much violation there is, or how much uncertainty there is, you know, whether it's maximal and things like that. And given the way, I mean, using the methods that I use just to get those very trivial results, I wouldn't be the way to do it. So I'm not really sure. If you're asking, do I have a quantitative estimate for how much uncertainty there is in the momentum of the lab as a result of the system, the answer is I don't know. But what I'm sure of is that although making the lab very massive would reduce its change in velocity, it wouldn't reduce the change in momentum at all.
Now, this isn't your surprising result an artifact of your model, of your example? Maybe you
should. Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's a good question. I actually don't think it is. I did do a similar calculation in admittedly almost equally simple models of measurement and get similar results. But it is possible it's an artifact of the model. But I don't think it is. I mean, I don't have a proof that it is. I don't know how such a proof would go, except to say every model measurement must look like X. Here's proof that in all those models, this result. Or I don't know how to do that, because I don't know how to do that every model measurement must look like X part. But in every model measurement, which is only a few that I've looked at, I can get similar outcomes. And I think in the end, it's not surprising. I mean, I said it was surprising, but it's only surprising because, you know, there's no physical interaction between the particle and the lab. So in that sense, it looks surprising. But if you're sort of immersed in quantum mechanics, it's not terribly surprising. Because what it's telling you is you can't use the lab to define momentum. And you sort of knew that on sort of a priori grounds in quantum mechanics anyway, because you're already using it to define positions.
No more questions, I think. Rob wants to make an announcement, but that's first time speaking, and all the speakers are today.
So yeah, we've been asked to vacate this building by 5:30, but if you want to continue discussions, PI is open. So lots of room at PI if anyone wants to hang out.
Hey, they canceled the meeting. It's not recording anymore. Pardon me. It wasn't full.
It was. I thought it was back in. Yeah.
Also, I just don't pull it out. Okay.
I have a long MP3.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we heard about that. Okay. Do you have a laptop?